of adults are getting shots in arms. The next step, vaccinating kids. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, how you can enroll your child in a clinical trial for pediatric COVID vaccines right here in Jacksonville. It's 549-2937 to join us. Then later in the hour, marking the 120th anniversary of the city's 1901 Great Fire, we'll tell you about this weekend's fire run. First, though, the latest numbers on the pandemic. Florida added 5,885 new COVID cases Wednesday and 42 deaths. The total death toll from the virus across the state now stands at 34,476. Vaccinations. 8.6 million Florida residents have gotten at least one dose of vaccine. 5.9 million have gotten both. Now, that means only about 30% of the state's population so far is fully vaccinated. So go out and get your vaccine. And as more adults get the shot, one question many have asked over the months that we've been dealing with this is, when will vaccines be approved for use on children? Some news to share. A new Novavax pediatric COVID-19 clinical trial is opening in Jacksonville Monday with the opportunity for children aged 12 to 17 to take part. Some will get active vaccine, some will get a placebo. Dr. Michael Corrin, director of the Jacksonville Center for Clinical Research, who has conducted trials with Pfizer and Moderna, is heading up this new pediatric trial, and he's on the line. Dr. Corrin, good to have you back.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
So much interest in this, and here's our question to callers. What are your questions about pediatric vaccines for COVID and the new study in Jacksonville starting next week? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. So this is opening up Monday, May 3rd at your Center for Clinical Research. Doctor, how did this come about? Tell us what you'll be doing.
Yeah, it is. It's very, very exciting. So we did participate in the Novavax adult study earlier this year. And because of this keen interest in also treating younger people, we've been asked to participate in the pediatric study. And that will start for folks between 12 and 17 years old. And then after that, that group is put into the study and will go down as young as 6 months of age. So only go down to infants eventually based on FDA guidance. So just some general words. I love your comments about getting people out and getting vaccinated. Vaccines work. If you look around the world, countries that have been very aggressive at vaccinating their populations are seeing dramatic drops in their incidence of infection and, most importantly, death and hospitalization related to infection. And we're starting to see the same thing in the U.S., although in the last 6 to 8 weeks, we've been at a plateau, largely because the infection is still spreading very rapidly amongst younger people. Mm-hmm. So we need to now get younger people vaccinated and ultimately get kids vaccinated. And we're part of that project starting next week, as you point out.
There's not a lot of data around vaccine efficacy in children. So what kinds of data points are you hoping to accomplish that can really be used across the country and the world?
Of course, we want to make sure that the vaccine is safe and effective. Safe in terms of not causing any major side effects. We have no evidence that it should because so far these vaccines have been remarkably safe, despite some of the discussion about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. If you look at the overall safety of these vaccines, they're really quite remarkable. And they prevent the spread of disease. There's no question about that at this point. Novavax in particular is a company that we're working with that makes something called a protein therapeutic. What that means is that they genetically engineer the spike protein, and they combine that with something that tells the immune system that a small amount of this spike protein is adequate to elicit an immune response. That's called an adjuvant in our terminology. So using a small concentration of the spike protein with the adjuvant, we're able to get the immune system ready to fight off COVID-19 should somebody be exposed to it. Mm-hmm. So we're really excited about that because we're hoping that that strategy will actually eliminate or at least minimize the type of side effects that you get when you get a vaccine, such as chills, fevers, that sort of thing, as your immune system becomes activated.
Let us know your thoughts and questions about the Novavax trial for kids. Starting Monday in Jacksonville, would you want to enter your child? This is open to kids age 12 to 17. Open enrollment starting Monday, ages 6 to 11 will be enrolling hopefully this summer. Give us a call, 549-2937. You know, Dr. Korn, I want to bring this up. A very popular podcaster, Joe Rogan, the other day questioned vaccines, saying why should young people even get them? Because they have very little risk of getting seriously ill from COVID. He's taken a lot of criticism for that.
Right, right.
What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, interesting perspective. So in fairness to his point, and other people have made this point, and this would be a true statement, is that the particular characteristic of this virus is that younger people have a less severe illness. It's just true. And there's a big gradient in terms of the likelihood of dying or being hospitalized based on age. So if you're in your 80s or older and you get infected with COVID, your likelihood of dying is 1 in 4. But if you're 24 years or less and get COVID, your likelihood of dying is 1 in 5,000. Well, still, that's not zero. So there are some people that are young that still have horrible complications. That's number one. Number two, people who are younger who may not be that sick could spread it to others who are more vulnerable. So in terms of getting this whole thing in the rearview mirror and be able to create a normal lifestyle in our society, we need everybody to be vaccinated or at least immune to this illness. So to just it's a little bit selfish, I would say, to say, okay, well, we don't get that sick, so we'll only worry about ourselves and not other people. So keep in mind there's implications for kids in terms of going to school and infecting teachers and other staff members. There's implications, of course, to other family members. But most importantly is that we really don't know the long-term consequences of this virus. So there's a lot that we don't know, and why would you want to take a chance on the long-term consequences of something that we know causes heart issues and blood clotting and maybe long-term changes in your immune system? So my way of thinking, this is if you haven't made a choice between the vaccines, which are using your purified products, or this virus that's very, very unpredictable, why would you want to get the virus?
Right. Better to not have it than have it. Absolutely. Now, yeah. These vaccine trials are so interesting. I know a number of adults around the area participated in the Pfizer and Moderna trials in Jacksonville, which you were involved in. They raised their hands and said, I want to be a guinea pig. I want to do this.
We don't like that word guinea pig.
Sorry. Sorry about that. But they raised their hand and said, I want to be part of this. I want to do my civic duty. I want to help society, because that's really what people who participate in these trials are doing. They're helping determine if something's safe and effective for the large population. So now for this trial, parents will have to make the decision and say, I want my child to be enrolled in this. So what's your message out there for parents who are just now hearing about this?
Yeah, it's a great point you're making. And so being part of a research study is a great learning experience. So you're right. Some people do it for altruism and for a legacy effect. And it also is a tremendous learning experience. People are fascinated to see how new products get developed and all the safety elements that are in the protocols that we run, and just kind of the fun. It's fun to interact with the staff, to learn more about yourself, learn more about the disease. So it's interesting. We survey all of our patients who participate in clinical trials, and the rate of people who are willing to participate in a second clinical trial once they're in a first clinical trial is 99%. So 99 of 100 people who participate in one of these studies want to come back and do it again. So it's kind of a neat experience, and as you point out, you are contributing to the greater good, and you're also helping yourself. Keep in mind, you mentioned it's a blinded study. 2 out of 3 of the people who participate will get the active treatment immediately, and then there's what's called a crossover about 2 or 3 months down the road, in which anybody that's not vaccinated will become vaccinated. So everybody in the study will eventually get vaccinated. And you won't know it at first, and we won't know it.
I see.
But it's part of the process of creating scientific observations. And it's a neat process. So people seem to enjoy it.
Now, we've heard so much about the placebo effect. I'm curious, just to ask you before we go to callers, when you were conducting the clinical trials for Pfizer and Moderna, did adults who got the placebo report feeling sick? Did they think they were sick because they didn't know if they got the real vaccine or a placebo?
Yeah, there's some elements of that. People will try to say, okay, well, my arm hurts in this way. Maybe I get the real thing. I felt a little dizzy or had a low-grade fever, what have you, and try to make determinations about which they got. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're not. So it's kind of the fun of the process. But keep in mind, in this particular study, 2 out of 3 people will get the active product immediately.
Immediately. And we're talking about a new clinical trial for pediatric vaccines. This is a Novavax pediatric COVID-19 study opening Monday, May 3rd at the Jacksonville Center for Clinical Research. Parents, if you want to enroll your child, if you have a child age 12 to 17, we'll tell you how you can do that in a moment. But first, let's go to some calls. What are your questions about this? Vaccinating kids, 549-2937. John on the South Side. Hi, John.
How you doing, Miss Melissa?
All right, thanks. How are you?
I'm blessed. I got one question, and he basically said it. If we have hesitant about the vaccine now and the vaccine for the children, when he said that we don't know what it's going to do in the long run, is that not true for the vaccine we take it now?
So it sounds by your comments, John, you might be a little vaccine hesitant.
Well, I'm. In other words, Miss Melissa, you know, when they say, oh, they debunk the conspiracy theories, they never actually get and go side by side. So in other words, if I seen this video, then why can't the big networks take that same video that I seen and put their evidence up against it? This is how you debunk stuff. You can't debunk stuff by what you just saying out your mouth. So I am very hesitant, but I'm not an anti-vaxxer, but I'm hesitant because I know science. And they have not explained to the American people what the RNA does to the DNA. And if you put an RNA vaccine, this is in your body for life. They do not know. It takes about 5 years in research to really get the data to see what's happening. Right now, everybody is a petri dish right now. And I really don't want to make our children like that until we have at least 5 years of people being vaccinated.
All right,
and that's
John.
Just science.
So let me respond to that.
Sure.
John, I love this question. You set me up, so I love it. So let me explain a few things to the listeners and you. Number one is that the data are out there. And I actually don't disagree with you. I think people don't talk enough about the data. But for all the vaccines that have been authorized by the FDA, there is extensive data that's publicly available. And we know that within the first 6 months of getting the vaccine, your likelihood of dying is less if you receive the vaccine. Real hard data. Absolute likelihood of dying is less. Your likelihood of being hospitalized is way less. So we have real, very tangible data. That's number one. So number two is each vaccine has a different mechanism of working. So you mentioned the messenger RNA mechanism. Messenger RNA is the mechanism for 2 of the vaccines. It's the mechanism for the Pfizer vaccine and for the Moderna vaccine. But what you said that was not true is that messenger RNA is a particularly good product to use because it goes away really, really quickly. Messenger RNA is the way our body makes messages to different parts of the cells, and our body breaks it down almost immediately. So in fact, for the messenger RNA vaccines, you have to put them into a vehicle that allows them to stick around long enough so that they can produce the spike protein. But they're gone within 48 hours. That's different.
I'm talking about the vehicle. The vehicle is gone in 48 hours?
Which one?
The vehicle, the nanos, the vehicle.
The lipid nanoparticles? That's just little fat.
Yes, are they gone in 48 hours? Are they gone?
The lipids is constantly being metabolized by your body. You have constant things in your body. There's nothing left. Your body makes the spike protein from the messenger RNA, and then it's gone. Except your immune system has now been activated, and your immune system knows what's going on. That's really the breakthrough. So what you're pointing out is a common misperception that messenger RNA is actually very short-lived. Now, your point is reasonable because you're a very thinking person, and there are other vaccines that have different types of mechanisms. So, for example, Johnson & Johnson and the AstraZeneca uses an adenovirus. So you get, as you're getting a full virus, and adenoviruses have DNA, and DNA is a much more stable molecule than RNA, and that will stick around for a while. So if you're concerned about that, well, maybe you should pick the vaccine that you're comfortable with. You know, talk with your doctor about it. The other thing is that the Novavax that we're using now, the Novavax study that we're doing now, actually doesn't use any kind of genetic material. It's literally just using the spike protein. So that, again, elicits an immune response, and you're done. So you make a really, really good point that we should be factual, and you should actually study the different mechanisms of the different vaccines, because we actually have choices.
Thank you, John. And you know, I'm glad that John called, because he did express what I know you've heard a lot about, Dr. Corin. There is a sizable percentage of the population that's still vaccine hesitant. Only 30% of Florida adults are fully vaccinated. And the sooner more people can get vaccinated, the sooner we can leave this era behind. If a sizable number of people refuse to get the vaccine, this pandemic's just going to hang around and around and around for years.
You got it.
Which
you
is,
got it again.
You know,
I always remind people, you compare people. You know, again, there are uncertainties in science. We all acknowledge that. But there are also uncertainties of disease. And the uncertainties of disease are actually greater than the uncertainties of science in many cases.
Okay, so let's getting back to the kids. You said children as young as 6 months might eventually be part of the studies on this. And in particular, I know that physicians like yourself are looking to enroll their children in these clinical trials. That's interesting.
Yeah, very, very interesting. In fact, as soon as the word got out, I had numerous calls from physician colleagues to try to get their kids involved. So the fact that physicians are the first people calling should be an indicator to the general public that what we're doing is really important, and it should be thought through as really an interesting opportunity for your children.
Let me talk a little bit about the small group of children who have gotten seriously ill from COVID-19, including a coworker of ours here at WJCT. Her son has long COVID, essentially. He has been sick for months, very sick, and we're all worried about him. Susie tweets the show with an article from the Associated Press, a child who traveled to Hawaii with his vaccinated parents died after contracting COVID-19. He did have some underlying conditions. So the majority of children are not going to get seriously ill from this disease, but it is a risk for some children. We need to debunk the idea that kids can't get sick or die from COVID-19. And so how do you view that through the context of this trial you're conducting with kids?
Well, as I mentioned, you have to acknowledge both sides of the story, because if you don't, then just people get upset. So, again, many kids have mild illnesses, but as you point out, there's some that get really, really sick, and you don't know who that will be necessarily, and that's the uncertainty of all this. So I think the interesting point that you made in terms of physicians wanting their kids to be involved is because, as physicians, we understand that uncertainty. And we want to take the risk, and we see vaccines as a very simple insurance policy to prevent that potential horrible complication, or the long haul syndrome that you're mentioning, that is a real deal. We know that after people are infected with COVID-19, some people have chronic inflammation for months and months and months, and certainly that's something that's completely avoidable if you're protected.
Lots of tweets. Here's one: high schools should announce where kids can get vaxxed every day. If you haven't gotten one already, you could go with your parent or guardian, even to a pop-up clinic at the school gym. And here are some questions for you. If a breastfeeding mother has been vaccinated, does she pass those antibodies to her child if she's received the COVID vaccine? Someone wants to know.
Sure. So recently, the government, and this has been something the medical society has been talking about for a while, is that pregnant women should not be reluctant to get the vaccine. In terms of protection of the infant through breast milk, I couldn't answer that question. I don't know any specific data right now. There are, you know, antibodies are big molecules, and some of them get into breast milk, and some aren't as good at getting into breast milk. And once they hit the GI tract, it gets degraded. So I can tell you that breast milk will not be fully protective of an infant, but I can tell you the exact protection, if any, that occurs.
Okay. Another question from Twitter. Kids are often reluctant to get vaccinations. Might there be a nasal spray trial for kids age 6 to 11 on the horizon?
I like the way that person thinks. That'll be our clinical trial for next year. But as of now, we only have the old-fashioned needle.
Okay. Another, here's an email from a listener. What are the chances we will be able to get all school kids vaccinated before school starts in the fall? How, you know, at what point do you anticipate that the nation will open up vaccinations to America's kids?
Interesting question. I would say that we probably will have enough data by summer to justify more widespread vaccination. And how that plays out is really hard for me to predict. But it's not inconceivable that we would be able to have supply of vaccine for kids by early fall.
One more email. Please clarify what Dr. Corin said. RNA in the vaccine does not embed itself into a patient's DNA. That's what you were discussing with the caller a minute ago.
That is correct. Yeah, RNA works in the cytoplasm of cells, not in the nucleus of cells. And our bodies have enzymes that are constantly breaking down RNA. So RNA is intrinsically a molecule that has a very short life in the body. So that is true, and it does not, to repeat, does not embed itself into DNA.
Let's take one more call as we talk about a new Novavax CovinVax study for kids beginning in Jacksonville next week. We'll tell you how you can enroll your child in just a moment. But first, let's go to Dan in Ponte Vedra. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if the doctor could comment on when trials may begin with children in the special needs community and or adults and children specifically who may have a pre-existing condition such as a genetic disorder like Down syndrome.
Great question, Dan. Thank you for that. How about that, Dr. Corin?
Down syndrome patients are not excluded from our current trials. So they could participate now.
Okay, there you go. So with all of that said, tell us how parents who've been listening to this and might want to enroll their child, how they can do that and what the criteria are.
We're looking for children, as mentioned, between age 12 and 17 at this point. That age limit will drop at some point, but we're not sure exactly when. They need to be accompanied by their parents. People of that age group need to have the consent from the parents. And we get the assent from the child, meaning that they're willing to go along with it, even though they're not allowed to give legal consent. And it's fairly wide open. Obviously, if somebody is known to have some severe immune problems, we wouldn't include them in the trial. If they're on high doses of steroids, whatever reason, which would be very rare in the pediatric population, they would be excluded from the trial. But it's pretty wide open otherwise.
Should they call the Jacksonville Center for Clinical Research to...
Yes.
I'm assuming the slots are filling up quickly.
They are. And again, we do, quote, compete against other sites around the country. So there's a total of several thousand slots that will be available. And it's conceivable that this will be a one-week opportunity, at which point all the slots would be filled. The phone number would be 904-730-0166, 730-0166, or you can get us on the web at jaxresearch.com, jaxresearch.com.
There you go, jaxresearch.com, or call 730-0166. This begins Monday. They need to wait till Monday to contact you.
They can call this week and make an appointment.
Oh, they could call this week. Okay. JaxResearch.com. Check it out. And always so good to get your insights. Dr. Michael Corin, director of the Jacksonville Center for Clinical Research, will be very interested to check back with you once you finish this and see how it went.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And keep up the good work.
You too. Thanks so much. Much more still ahead later, how you can get outside and enjoy our beautiful North Florida this spring. Lots of ideas coming up in our wild Florida, but up next.
Collective trauma is a situation where the trauma is shared by a group of people or a country or the world in this situation.
How the nation and the world can heal from the collective trauma we've endured over the past year or so. We speak with the author of The Trauma Map next. Well, the past year, we have collectively faced a significant amount of trauma from the pandemic, political upheaval, racially motivated violence, and so much more. It's understandable that anxiety, depression, and trauma have increased among Americans. But it's also time to bring our attention to ways to start to heal. Dr. Carol Darsa is a trauma expert and psychologist, and in her new book, The Trauma Map, she examines why collective trauma can be so tough to deal with and has ideas on how you can start healing from the stress. I spoke with her. Take a listen. Dr. Darsa, hi. Good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I am so excited to talk with you about this because it's been on my mind for months now. This whole issue in our society of collective trauma, all of us, I think, are dealing with this in one way or another. We are traumatized by this pandemic and everything that we've been through over the last year. I think we had collective trauma in America way before the pandemic, but it's really acute now. So in your book, The Trauma Map, you talk about how people can start to heal from this kind of situation. Can you first kind of explain to everyone how you define collective trauma?
Sure. Collective trauma is a situation where the trauma is shared by a group of people or a country or the world in this situation. And I should also define trauma because it's any event that renders the person really feeling powerless or helpless or gives sense of overwhelm, mm-hmm. where the ability to cope really gets disrupted.
Yeah.
And in this situation, the collective trauma is unfortunately shared by everyone right now. And so there is really sort of no place to go for refuge. Where then the collective stress becomes even much more stressful than a person experiencing this on an individual basis.
Yeah. The powerlessness we all feel about the pandemic and these challenges we're all facing, I think that's a good way to put it. I know for myself, I've created all these little routines and rituals every day just to kind of feel as though I'm at least in a little bit of control of what's happening in my life. So you have identified ways that individuals and how we as a society can deal with collective trauma. What do you advise people to do? Because people are suffering. What should they do to try to begin a healing process from this last year?
Actually, you said a very important point already yourself. You created some routines and rituals. So a sense of structure is a very important one because we feel really, again, overwhelmed, sort of, it almost like a sense of being out of a container, right? We're just mm-hmm. like losing ourselves. So, and that's what often trauma does, a sense of disconnect, a sense of loss. So it's all about finding ways to reconnect and feel together. Right? So rituals are great. Really taking care of yourself on different levels. So for instance, physical exercise, walks, or if you're doing maybe yoga or any other type of workout, it's not just because we want to look good, but it really gives us a sense of connecting to our bodies so that we're not all the time in our minds. Because often when there's something so overwhelming, we just go into our thoughts and we start ruminating. What are we going to do? What's going to happen? And there's a lot of worry about the future or the worry about what's happening now. And when that happens, we leave our body. So the sense of connecting back to the body by different type of movement or exercise could be very helpful in that way. So that's one way mm-hmm. to find some sense of peace. Another way is really to take care of your feelings. That's another tendency that we have, is to just actually put feelings aside and not wanting to deal with them, right? We think if we just distract ourselves, we'll be actually feeling better. But it really doesn't work that way. So we have to first just validate that what we're feeling is normal and it's okay, rather than judge it, or rather than wanting to be sort of stronger or not have any feelings or not wanting to be impacted by it. It's just not how it is. When something is that stressful or that traumatic, we just validate it and say, okay, I'm not alone. I'm not crazy. This makes sense. And then maybe just spending some time, maybe expressing your feelings with people. You can journal about it. You can have a support group where you're allowed to express your feelings and just sort of get a feedback. So there's ways to really face them.
To face this. Can you explain, too, there's a difference between stress and trauma. I think we all have had a lot of stress in this pandemic, but trauma is at a deeper level. What's the difference?
The difference is really how we're coping with it. Because the same incident could be a stress for one person, but could be traumatic for someone else. Divorce is such, for instance. For some people, it's not as traumatic. So if you find yourself sort of out of control where you really can't cope with it, it's more that you're traumatized by it. And also, it's the chronic, a chronic incident, for instance. I think when pandemic first hit, we were all sort of, yes, very stressed, but we thought this would end in, I don't know, 2 weeks, 4 weeks maximum.
Yeah, right.
That's good.
Yeah.
That was going to last that long. And so when the chronic stress, you know, day after day, month after month, that it can become much more traumatic, because now our coping skills have decreased. And that's what I saw with the clients or with the populations that I work with. At first, there was sort of a peak of reactions, and then people kind of plateaued a little bit and felt somewhat okay. We're kind of getting used to it. They were saying this is a new norm. And then it started peaking again because they were expecting that it would have ended. And when they saw it didn't end, a lot of people had mental health issues coming up.
Now, your book is called The Trauma Map. What does the reference to the map indicate?
Because I give a roadmap to how to find yourself after a traumatic experience. So there's sort of a step-by-step ways to get there. That's why.
And this is what you call a body-based method, too. As you said, a lot of this is just getting back in touch with your body to sort of release this trauma, which can often be repressed, too.
Very much. Well, what happens is current stress or current trauma can trigger past trauma. And that's another way of indicator. So if you've had a maybe healthy childhood or a good foundation growing up in your life, and maybe you've probably had some stress but nothing so traumatic, and then you are hit with pandemic, you're more likely not to be traumatized. You're probably going to feel that it's pretty stressful. But if you already grow up in a house that maybe was not stable and you had a lot of, or maybe medical issues, and all of a sudden now you're, you know, facing a pandemic. Like, you could get not only sick, but there's a risk of dying. Mm-hmm. You can only imagine the fear of that person having gone through a difficult childhood. And so that, it becomes much more. And that's why a lot of people who, I don't know if you know, but there's a huge increase of addiction since the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Because addiction, it's not something that people became addicted during pandemic. These people had addiction, and some of them were sober, and they relapsed because they couldn't hold on to the stress. They couldn't deal with it. Same thing with post-traumatic stress disorder. So if you were feeling somewhat okay, and then this, you know, these fears, these threats are coming into your face in the whole world, and you could struggle with PTSD again.
There are so many Americans that are dealing with this in one way or another. So it's such a timely book, and I really recommend it. I want to thank you so much for joining us. She's Dr. Carol Darsa, trauma expert, psychologist, and author. The book is called The Trauma Map, 5 Steps to Reconnect with Yourself. check it out and pick up a copy for you or someone who's suffering. Dr. Darsa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you again. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Well, one healing activity is to just get outside and enjoy our beautiful corner of Florida, especially because the weather is perfect right now. It's not too hot just yet. Our regular contributor, Lisa Gruba, is an environmental journalist and Florida master naturalist. She's on the line with some wild Florida ideas for us for the month of May. Hey, Lisa, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
So good to have you back on. So what's on your radar this month outdoors?
Well, we are in mid to late spring here in North Florida. We're in shorts and flip-flop weather during the day, maybe still a jacket early morning or late evening. Weatherman Mike Burrish says we are going to get into the high 80s within a week or two, so get out and get your hiking in soon.
Yes, yes.
North Atlantic right whales, which have been in our coastal waters since December, have headed back up north, and I just saw a report that 17 calves were born this winter season, which is really good for a species that is down to 360 total.
Oh, my goodness.
So that is, that's great news. There was one calf that was killed by a boat that was coming into St. Augustine Inlet in February, so 16 survived. And so that's just something we have to continue to work on is being vigilant when the right whales are here. We've got sea turtles coming on shore just in the last couple of weeks to nest, and they come up and nest in the dune area. So we should see the first hatchlings maybe late May, early June, and they will be nesting through October. So the saying is clean, flat, dark at the beaches this time of year. And what that means is leave the beaches clean and flat, because sea turtles, as you can imagine, aren't the most coordinated of species on land.
Yeah.
They can't even back up. So if they hit a hole that somebody has dug, or if they hit, something that's been left on the beach, they just get stuck. So pack out all your belongings at the end of the day, fill in the holes. And if you live up near the beaches, minimize your outdoor lighting.
I have a cup that the group that works with the sea turtles gave me, and it says, I'm drinking from it right now, clean. It says clean, flat, dark. I actually have that cup in my hand right now. So that's a great, that's a great tip, Lisa.
Yeah. So nature's kind of going about doing what it always does, but humans are getting busy again. And so we're starting to see a lot more events. The first one I want to tell people about is a movie that's playing this Sunday, May 2nd, at Sunray Cinema in Five Point. It's called Kiss the Ground, and it's a documentary narrated by the actor Woody Harrelson that talks about bringing back some old farming methods that would help rejuvenate our soil and help fight climate change effects. And I've seen the trailer to it, and it looks like a really beautiful, inspiring film. Mm. It is streaming on Netflix, but if you go to Sunray's event, they then have a local panel afterwards, and that will be led by Ashante Green, who is an elected member of the Duval County Soil and Water Conservation District, and panelists who work in that field in our area, Tiffany Best, Alan Skinner, Mike Kilcourse, and Alan Moore, will be there to give us the local perspective on that.
Is this a ticketed event?
It is, and you can go on to Sunray's website. I think the tickets were like $12, and you can choose your seat. Go ahead and get your tickets, and it's 3:30 on Sunday.
Okay, check that out. And you've also got something involving the Jacksonville Parks Department you wanted to mention too, correct?
Yes. So every month, the naturalists, I think we have three naturalists that work for our parks department here in Jacksonville. They put on different events at parks all over the city, and they rotate the park. And in May, there are 17 events they're hosting at 10 different parks, from Wildflower Walk to bike rides to trail talk. And I went out and toured all the different parks, and it was amazing to see the diversity of our park system. And these parks are also located all over the city. So, you know, no matter where you live in the city, there's going to be an event close by. They're at the Atlantic Ocean, off of Heckscher, Julington, Durbin Creek, Mandarin, Arlington, the Trout River, and the West Side. And all of the parks are really different. So some of them, like McGirt's Creek Preserve and Losco Regional Park, they kind of have ball fields, playgrounds, picnic pavilions, in addition to a wooded area. And some of the parks are very undeveloped, like Sal Taylor Creek Preserve, which I had never heard of. It's out by Cecil Field, and it abuts Jennings State Forest, and it's very undeveloped. It is, you know, you're deep in the woods when you get out there. And in fact, when you get out of the car, there's a sign that says you are in bear country.
Mm.
So there's a real variety of parks. There's something for everybody. And the events are like 45 minutes long. So, you know, if you work from home and have some flexibility, maybe you can take that as your lunchtime someday and go to one of these events.
And where can people find that list?
So it's available on my website, Florida Field Notes, which is also can link to it through WJCT's website. And the city website, the Parks Department, has more detail. And I have that link also on my site on Florida Field Notes.
Okay. And before we let you go, let's also mention that you did a great job guest editing our digital magazine, AdaptFlorida.org. And recently did a piece on green infrastructure for the First Coast.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And if you haven't had a chance to check that out, the most interesting thing I found about that is that the city of Atlanta has 6,000 examples of green infrastructure that they've incorporated into their built environment. And green infrastructure is using nature rather than just an engineered system. They've got 6,000 examples. So this isn't a concept anymore. This is a reality. And I'm hearing a lot of people in our community talk about these types of ideas, whether it's in their own yard or things they'd like to see in the city. So check out the article on AdaptFlorida.org, and let's keep the community conversation going. This is really an up-and-coming topic, and you know, we'll see some really interesting changes in coming years.
Yeah, let's hope so.
In how we manage stormwater and things like that.
Yeah, definitely needed. And I want to thank you for your insights and expertise. Always good to get some tips from Lisa on how to get outdoors. She's Lisa Gruba, environmental journalist, Florida Master Naturalist, and it's Wild Florida for May. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you, Melissa. Good talking to you.
And in a moment, the Jacksonville Historical Society marks the 120th anniversary of the Great Fire of 1901. We'll tell you about this weekend's 5K, the Fire Run. That's next.
Lee & Kate's Glass, family-owned and operated for 95 years. Lee & Kate's Glass is your source for upgrading your home's glass, from shower doors and mirrors to windows and tabletops. Learn more at leeandkatesglass.com. Mayo Clinic. If you're looking for answers no one else has been able to find, and it's time to get some certainty once and for all, you know where to go. Mayo Clinic. More at mayoclinic.org/Florida.
I'm Robin Young. Ah, the songs of spring as the winter world leaves and the what is that exactly returns? We'll get a primer on spring bird songs across the country next time, here and now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Mbolo Mbwe. Her new novel, How Beautiful We Were, is about a fictional African village that tries to fight back against an American oil company that has polluted their land. Her first novel, Behold the Dreamers, was a New York Times bestseller and won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
America has produced some of the world's most influential electronic music. Sounds composed by and brought to life on computers and machines played by women.
It was always on. It was alive. It was warm. It was generating.
I'm Jen White. We'll meet some of those who star in a new groundbreaking documentary, Sisters with Transistors. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it was one of the worst disasters in Florida history. On May 3rd, 1901, Jacksonville burned to the ground. In just 8 hours, the fire burned 146 city blocks, destroyed more than 2,000 mostly wooden buildings, and left about 10,000 residents homeless. It was said the glow from the flames of the fire in Jacksonville could be seen as far away as Savannah, Georgia. And the smoke plumes were viewed all the way up in Raleigh, North Carolina. The city's Great Fire remains the third largest urban fire in the U.S. after the Great Chicago Fire and the 1906 San Francisco Fire. But from the ashes of the flames in 1901, this city would slowly rebuild. And now, 120 years later, the Jacksonville Historical Society is marking the anniversary of the Great Fire with a 5K this weekend called the Fire Run. It's a way to support local historic preservation, get outside, and get some exercise. I got a preview from Alan Bliss, CEO of the Jacksonville Historical Society. Hey, Alan, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Melissa.
All right, let's talk about the Great Fire Run of 2021. This commemorates, as I said, the 120th anniversary of the city's Great Fire. Hard to believe it's been that long. Let's talk about the run, and then you can tell us about the history. How about that?
All right. Well, the fire, the run will take place on Saturday, May 1st this year, and the kickoff, the start, is at Old St. Andrew's Church, the headquarters church of the Jacksonville Historical Society. That's at 3178 Philip Randolph Boulevard, right next to the baseball grounds, right across from the ViStar Veterans Memorial Arena. As you said, it follows the outline of the boundary of the Great Fire, roughly, that took place on May 3rd, 1901. The start of the initial race is at 7:30, and we'll also have a 1K that begins at 8:30. And sign-up is still going on, and people can sign up at the website runsignup.com. And there's full information about registration and the other race day details there.
Runsignup.com. And, of course, naturally, Firehouse Subs is your title sponsor, Jacksonville's own headquartered Firehouse Subs. Gotta love that.
We're honored to have Firehouse with us. We also have a number of other sponsors, generous support from individuals and businesses, The Resident, ViStar, Manifest Distillery, the Milam Howard Law Firm, Marks Gray, a number of old Jacksonville firms that have a history in this city themselves.
Let's go back to May 3rd, 1901, when, I didn't know this, it was spark from a kitchen fire lit up piles of drying Spanish moss at a mattress factory downtown and burned down much of the city's urban core. Tell us about the Jacksonville Great Fire.
2,368 buildings were destroyed by the fire. There were 7 fatalities and thousands of people were left homeless. 146 city blocks were destroyed, and considered that at the time, the core area around downtown Jacksonville constituted most of what was the city at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It had a huge impact on Jacksonville, not just in the moment, but its reach in the decades after really made a big difference. It sparked, if you'll pardon the pun, a renovation and kind of a renaissance in downtown development, in architecture and construction techniques. It had an effect on Jacksonville very similar to that of the Chicago Great Fire.
So a mixed blessing in that sense. People have often commented, though, that if we hadn't had the fire, Jacksonville would be a tourist destination like Jacksonville, or excuse me, like Charleston or Savannah, because we would have kept more of our historic buildings. What do you think about that?
I'm not so sure that's true, because a lot of the buildings that constituted Jacksonville's downtown core were wood frame construction, and that's part of the reason why the city burned so easily. It's one of the reasons why Chicago burned so readily. Both Jacksonville and Chicago grew up in the late 19th century in a countryside that had a ready supply of trees that could be felled and processed into timber for construction. It made for quick and cheap and easy development and rapid growth. And both cities did grow fast, but they grew on the strength of their natural environment, which was timber. And most of the construction that post-dated our Great Fire was masonry and steel reinforced. It was modern construction. And, of course, now it's construction that's over a century year old. But at the time, mm-hmm. it was cutting edge.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is great history. If people come and run and be, they're part of the Great Fire Run, they're supporting the work of the Jacksonville Historical Society so that you can keep this history alive.
It is. It's a nice fit because we believe that the more people know about and understand the history of a place, the more easily it is a place that they can take ownership of and become citizens in. And citizenship is a virtue that we really believe in and that we think fits in well with history. So experiencing the area of the Great Fire with the run is a great way to appreciate what was one of the most really influential events in Jacksonville's history.
Right. The run will trace the outline of the actual fire boundary through downtown. So get your tickets now at runsignup.com. It is the Jacksonville Historical Society's 5K and 1 mile race fundraiser, the Great Fire Run, coming up Saturday, May 1st. And he is Alan Bliss, CEO of the Jacksonville Historical Society. Alan, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Melissa. Hope to see you on May 1st.
Have fun. Going to be great weather. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.